The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent, including Olas Media.
Olas Media. Olas Media presents Nation State of Play.
Welcome to the Nation State of Play podcast. I'm your host, Brian Miller. On each episode, we explore the political stories that are driving public policy in California. We explore these stories with political insiders, business leaders, journalists, and policymakers themselves to get below the surface of the headlines and show you the true forces shaping our nation state. Well, thanks for listening today. We have a really special guest, Will Rollins, who is a candidate for Congress in Southern California. This is one of the most closely watched races in the country, so really excited to have Will on to talk about the race. We have a sort of a wide-ranging conversation. We talk a lot about the Supreme Court Dobbs decision and specifically the impact that that case might have on LGBTQ rights. And Will is running as an openly gay candidate, and I think he's going to have a real say in these issues. We also talk about the latest in the January 6th investigations, and we talk about a whole host of district-specific issues with the long-time-serving Republican who Will is running against. So it's a really interesting race, one of the ones that's going to decide who controls the House of Representatives after the next election. So hope you will listen. Will Rollins coming up right after this.
With more than 30 years in law enforcement, California prosecutor Anne Marie Schubert recounts historic cases on Inside the Crime Files. From the Golden State Killer to the Second Story Rapist, go behind the scenes with detectives to hear what didn't make the headlines. A Sacramento district attorney to international heroine of forensic science, Anne Marie explains how she's held criminals accountable and exonerated the innocent. Olas Media presents Inside the Crime Files with Anne Marie Schubert. Listen and subscribe on olasmedia.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Nation State of Play podcast. All right. Well, Will, thanks so much for being on the show today. It is a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Your race is fascinating. This is one of the most closely watched national races. It's being covered by a big article in the New York Times a few weeks ago and lots of other press. Why don't we start with the geography, because this district has changed a lot. Tell us a little bit about the 41st and how people should be thinking about exactly where this is and who lives in it.
Sure. So this district went from a Trump plus seven in October of 2021 when I launched to essentially a toss-up now after redistricting. And the reason that happened is because it lost very Republican cities in Southern California, like Murrieta and Northern Temecula. And it picked up cities like Palm Springs, Rancho Mirage, Palm Desert, La Quinta, all of which voted for Joe Biden in 2020. And so it caused essentially a 7-point swing in registration for Democrats and now put us in a position where we actually outnumber registered Republicans for the first time in the history of Ken Calvert's tenure in Congress, going back all the way to 1992.
Great. And I think he's the longest serving GOP member of the California congressional delegation. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And he hasn't had a ton of serious challenges over the years because he has been in a deep, deep red district. In fact, the closest any Democrat has ever come to beating him was a guy named Bill Hedrick in 2008, came within, I think, 2 or 3 points and raised a total of $215,000 for the entire congressional cycle, which tells you just how competitive the seat has been historically, right? And, you know, unfortunately, with our campaign finance system being the way that it is, you know, $215,000 is just not enough to flip Southern California House seat, as great a candidate as Bill Hedrick was. I think the fact that he came within a few points just shows you how vulnerable Calvert really is when we have the resources to get our message out.
That's really helpful context. So let's talk a little bit about Calvert's record, because, you know, I think he falls in this group of Southern California Republicans who are trying to make themselves sound like moderates all of a sudden on the eve of an election where that seems to be the thing they think will help him. But, you know, as you just pointed out, he's got a very long voting record. Before the recent stuff on January 6th, which I definitely want to dwell on, let's kind of go back in time a little bit and where he's been on choice and LGBTQ issues and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with choice, because I think that is one of the most extreme records that he has. 1995, this guy already voted for a national abortion ban with no exceptions to save the life of a woman. That is a pretty remarkable position to take, one that he has been trying to forget in the last couple of weeks here. He's also voted to allow child predators to sue to prevent their victims from getting an abortion. He joined the lawsuit to overturn Roe, and just a couple of months ago voted against a federal law designed to protect access to contraception. So about as far to the right as you can get on an issue like choice, and, you know, believes that it's okay to prosecute women and their doctors for abortion, believes that is how we should use the criminal law in the United States. So that's his record on choice. And when it comes to LGBTQ rights, just as extreme. Originally started his political career by outing his opponent, Mark Takano, who later was elected to Congress in 2012, but in the early 90s, outed Congressman Takano as part of a political strategy, sent homophobic pink flyers throughout the congressional district, warning people of, you know, a secret gay agenda. He's voted against the Matthew Shepard hate crimes bill in 2009, which of course is a law just designed to protect gay kids and men and women all over the country from being targeted and killed for being who they are. Voted against repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Voted against gay marriage historically too, and has joined lawsuits that are extremely geared towards taking rights away from LGBTQ Americans. And just 16 months ago, voted against the Equality Act, which is a law really just designed to prevent gay people from being kicked out of their homes for being who they are or being fired from employment for being who they are. So a real extremist.
So I want to, there's a lot of amazing votes there. This recent vote that the Republicans took against the federal right to contraception, I want to dwell on that for a second, because that, I feel like that hasn't gotten as much attention as it deserves nationally and in some of these races. I'm sure you're out talking about it every day. But we had NARAL on a few weeks ago, and they were doing a good job of bringing it up. What is going on in their minds? You think, I'm asking you to do something weird here, which is I'm asking you to get in the mind of your opponent, but you know him better than anybody else at this point. And that's just a hard one for me to figure out from a political perspective. Why wouldn't McCarthy give at least the Southern California members, who he knows those districts very well, why wouldn't he give them a free pass on a vote like that? Like, just as a political matter, what do you think's going on there?
I wish I had a brilliant answer to that question, but the truth is that I don't, because it's mind-blowing to me. The fact that you've got members of Congress who would be willing to vote against your right to go into a store and buy a condom or to buy birth control or any other form of contraception that exists is just astonishing to me. And I think the gift that idiotic vote has given to candidates like me is the ability to build a coalition of people all across the political spectrum, all the way to libertarians who believe that the government shouldn't have a place in your bedroom. And so, you know, I think that the closest I can come to giving an answer about those votes is that they are so scared of the fundamentalist religious base that they believe still has a significant amount of political power in the United States, that they felt compelled to give them those no votes, because they genuinely believe that God does not want premarital sex. And if you genuinely believe that, and you believe you should impose that view on other people, regardless of their own personal religious beliefs or the lack of religious belief, then you would vote against protecting the right to contraception. And I think they're pandering to those extremes, even though 90% plus of the United States, at least, right, believes that we should have the freedom over our own bodies, and certainly that women should have the freedom to control their own destinies.
Okay, it's fascinating, ironic, and hypocritical on all levels. You may be hesitant to bring this up, but I will. Calvert did get caught with a prostitute in his car at one point. Can we just all acknowledge that that happened? I mean, it was not an arrest, but that happened, right?
That happened. It happened. It was covered in the press. And, you know, the one of the worst parts of that is that he lied about it to his constituents for a year, I think, at least about. And it was only after, through litigation, where they were able to get the police report that he finally admitted to what had happened. And so the hypocrisy of taking a position on contraception, on women's rights to control their own body, given his own history, is pretty remarkable. And, you know, the good news is I think that in a close election like this, more and more voters are remembering that incident and thinking about the kind of hypocritical positions that this guy has taken over the years. And they know that he just can't be trusted.
Okay, so there's another vote the last few weeks. You've alluded to this, but I'm curious as to how this is playing on the campaign trail. Before Lindsey Graham introduced the national abortion ban, I felt like it was kind of hard to get Californians to actually be concerned about the impact to us from Dobbs. You know, the convention was like, oh, well, you know, that's never going to happen here. And we're going to pass Amendment 1 this cycle, presumably, and we already have a constitutional right. But all of a sudden, now that seems like a very real threat. It would just take a House majority, which, you know, let's be honest, flip up a coin one way or the other at best at the moment, and a Senate majority, and they're only a few seats away, and a president presumably to sign it. You know, I'm quite sure McConnell would find a way to eliminate the filibuster for that vote if he needed to. How has Lindsey Graham's introduction of that bill changed the discussion in your point of view?
I think it's been helpful because for Democratic candidates, we're able to talk about the difference between federal and state law, right? And to call out some of the unbelievably disingenuous responses from people like the chair of the RNC, who's saying, oh, it's going to be left up to the states. People like my opponent, Ken Calvert, saying, oh, I think it's going to be left up to the states. The difference between federal and state law is that if it's a federal law, it's not left up to the states. There's a supremacy clause in the U.S. Constitution. And the fact that these Republican leaders are trying to have it both ways, to both introduce a national abortion ban and then tell their constituents in these moderate districts that it's going to be left up to Californians and Californians are going to be safe, is just another sign of how they are willing to say and do anything, including lie to their voters, in order to keep power. And I think as candidates on the Democratic side of the aisle, we cannot say enough just how dangerous it is to give control of Congress to the far right in this country at this moment. Because, you know, the other day I just saw Ronna McDaniel avoiding this question on a TV interview, saying that I think it's going to be left up to the voters in the states. And that's just completely false. Lindsey Graham's introduction of the national ban proves it. None of them have come out and said that they're opposed to the national ban. In fact, many of them have done just the opposite. And as I said a second ago, Ken Calvert already has voted for a national abortion ban in 1995 with no exceptions to save the life of a woman. And so I think the fact that Lindsey Graham chose to introduce the bill when he did, again, in my view, an attempt to placate and pander to some of the most extreme elements of the Republican Party, has been a boon to Democrats because we are able to point out the hypocrisy and the truth of what the long-term strategy is. And when people tell you who they are, as many others have said the last few months, you should believe them. And that's where they're taking the country.
I want to ask you one really wonky, nerdy legal follow-up on this. I promise not to dwell on this, but you're an expert in federal law and you very much understand state versus federal jurisdiction. This has been nagging at me. If that were to pass, worst case scenario, is there any chance that that could be challenged constitutionally on the grounds that Congress does not have that jurisdiction under interstate commerce or some other? And I was like, where in the Constitution are they trying to like pretend that they have the authority to do that, ironically, for the, you know, party of supposedly limited government?
There's probably a variety of creative constitutional challenges you could bring to a national abortion ban, but unfortunately that cuts both ways, right? The Commerce Clause that I think Democrats would want to use in part to pass a federal law protecting access to abortion, given the current makeup of the Supreme Court, you know, there's possibly a 5-4, even a 6-3 majority there that would hold that the Commerce Clause prohibits that kind of federal legislation, which is why I think at some point there is going to need to be a constitutional amendment to protect the right of access to contraception and abortion in the United States long term. I think in the meantime, you know, what we've got to do as Democrats is keep the House, pick up a couple more U.S. Senate seats and get that federal bill passed and adapt and be nimble if conservative federal judges start striking down legislation that's designed to protect a woman's right to choose at the federal level. And there's a lot of things that a Democratic majority could do to protect women's reproductive freedoms under that scenario, right? The possibility of expanding the number of judges on the federal judiciary, not necessarily at the Supreme Court, but at the lower circuit courts. I think reforming the way that the U.S. Supreme Court works, given that it has become a partisan tool essentially of the Republican Party after they've broken so many norms the past few years to essentially rig a 6-3 majority, despite having won only two popular elections for the White House since I think it was 1987, right? That's a pretty remarkable stat that shows just how far out of touch with the vast majority of Americans this court is. And they rely on public trust in order to maintain their legitimacy in part, right? They cannot get so far out of step with constitutional norms and a half century of precedent upheld by both Republican and Democratic justices alike for the last half century and expect that there won't be a check and a balance on their power. And I think that there absolutely should be.
I seemingly at least four members thought that, or five, I guess. I mean, I'm sort of putting Roberts in this, you know, he was trying to have it both ways, but he ultimately did vote with the majority opinion. And I'm sure you've read every word of the case, and I want to talk about Thomas's dissent and his concurrence, and specifically what he said about gay marriage, because I mean, that to me also hasn't gotten enough attention. I know people have tried to talk about it, but I mean, if everyone should read Thomas's concurrence, he basically said, hey, if we're throwing out this and I'm all for it, we should throw out everything. And that includes the right to gay marriage, right to contraception, right to interracial marriage. That's rich because he's married to a white woman the last time I checked. But what do you think the long-term impact of Dobbs is going to be on the gay marriage debate in this country?
Yeah, I mean, his concurrence tells you exactly what the complete logic of the opinion really is. And even conservative commentators after Dobbs have said that that's exactly what the court's opinion undermines, right? Every single one of the precedents that Thomas called into question, I mean, to his credit, that's intellectually honest. And he does hold those positions. And I think a majority of the court holds those positions too, even though they've given us a wink and a nod in some other language in that opinion. I don't think anybody can trust that kind of language coming from justices who already misled the United States Senate when they were under oath during their confirmation hearings. And when you have Thomas telling you exactly what the full throated logic of the opinion actually is, and all of the other precedents with substantive due process now at play, and going back to Griswold versus Connecticut, right? Again, you know, right to contraception, and all of these sort of cases that are around the right to personal autonomy and freedom in your bedroom, they all rely on the precedent that Dobbs just completely threw out the window in many ways, right? So I think it's a huge threat, and it's why I've been saying, you know, if I win, I'll be the second openly gay guy in the House from California in history. And I've been saying when I'm campaigning across the district, especially in places like Palm Springs with a huge LGBTQ community, you know, our right for freedom is bound up in women's freedom and women's right to control their own futures. Because if we don't stand together right now in this moment, the next couple cycles, I think, are among the most crucial in the history of the United States, and they're going to dictate where our country goes in the 21st century. And this is an absolutely urgent moment for our democracy. And that's why I've been working as hard as humanly possible to make sure I flip this seat in 36 days on November 8th.
Yeah, it's so well said. These two issues, I think now it should be clear to everybody, they're inextricably intertwined. And I also agree, to Thomas's credit, he's the only one being intellectually honest in the majority there. And I think everybody needs to read that opinion, because I just think there's no way around that logic. Actually, I just want to point out one other sort of wonky but thing that I found really terrifying about the case is it was not at all clear that a majority of the judges think that one state could somehow interfere with interstate travel to another state to have an abortion. In fact, Kavanaugh wrote a concurrence on this, and I think he was the sole signer of it. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, the opinion is premised on this idea of like, well, Roe didn't resolve anything, therefore it was okay to overrule it. Like, that's sort of their exception to precedence. But then the dissent, I think, was rightfully pointing out, like, you haven't resolved anything. Now we're just going to have this series of cases fighting about interstate fights on the people needing to travel to get abortions. And I think that, again, I think that's gotten lost in the headlines. But where do you see that issue currently? You're an expert, again, in constitutional law. I mean, are we going to be dealing with, you know, Alabama trying to prosecute citizens of Alabama who come to California for an abortion? I mean, what's the future here?
I mean, yes, I think we absolutely could see that. We could see these states trying to prosecute women who are traveling across state lines to get an abortion. We've already seen legislators across the country, especially in southern states, talking about introducing these kinds of bills, again, to placate an extremely far right base that just believes we should live in some version of The Handmaid's Tale. I mean, so those are credible threats. And even if those state laws don't ultimately survive constitutional scrutiny because of the ability for people to move across state lines and the protection for interstate travel under the U.S. Constitution, that is going to take a lot of litigation. And I don't necessarily see this 6-3 majority coming down that way on abortion in particular and prosecutions, because there have not been a ton of challenges in that area for interstate travel when it comes to criminalization of a particular type of conduct like abortion. And so if this court concludes, well, Alabama has decided abortion is a crime, therefore they can go after anybody in their jurisdiction who decides to get an abortion, and there's absolutely nothing that can be done about that, and there is no freedom to travel across interstate lines if you commit a state crime in Alabama and want to go to a neighboring state, I mean, that's the U.S. Supreme Court could absolutely decide the case that way. And I think it dovetails with what they're trying to do at the federal level, because if they pass a federal ban, then the whole point is moot, because anybody who's traveling who violates the federal ban, not only is local law enforcement coming after them, but FBI agents are waiting for them at the airport when they land, because they've, you know, gone into their email accounts and seen that they've made an appointment to get, or even thought about leaving the country if they pass a national ban. I mean, these are serious Orwellian nightmare scenarios that every single voter should be asking Republican candidates about in every single congressional district across the country. How are the mechanics of federal law enforcement agents tracking down women and doctors actually going to work? How do you propose that works? Because they have all voted, for the most part, a lot of them have voted for that kind of prosecution at the federal level. And as a former federal prosecutor, that horrifies me.
Well, you know, well said, terrifying, but I'm glad we could have this talk, because I think the things you just talked about there, like, this is the next round of cases, the futures we're going to be arguing about in the next few years. And, you know, all this stuff's going to have huge implications. We have not heard the end of this stuff at the Supreme Court by any stretch of the imagination. Okay, I want to move on to January 6th. You're an expert in national security law. You've done prosecutions in this area. You've been really brave, I think, and bold talking about this on the campaign trail. But let me just start with a high level question. Do you think the January 6th hearings have helped the public understand what happened?
I think there's a segment of the Republican Party for whom the hearings won't make any difference at all. But I do think that for a huge chunk of the public that hadn't made up their minds about it, or who didn't know fully the full chronology and timeline and history of Trump's efforts to overturn the last presidential election, I think the hearings have been enormously powerful. And I think some of the most powerful testimony from those hearings has been from people like Rusty Bowers and Brad Raffensperger, because these are people who were fervent, diehard Trump supporters who were personally threatened, whose families were threatened after they simply stood up and said, I cannot swear to you that this election was stolen. I cannot violate my oath of office. I cannot violate my oath to the U.S. Constitution, even though I wish you had won. And when independents and moderate Republicans, even moderate Republicans who voted for Donald Trump the last time around, they see the testimony of his former supporters at those hearings, and it is incredibly powerful. And so I do think that among independents and the folks in the Republican Party who are still reachable, and I know there's a decent chunk of them, there's probably 40% of the Republican Party, which I believe is ready to vote for a different candidate this cycle, in part because those hearings have helped explain just how serious the threat to our democracy was. And they've done it in a way that's been succinct and politically powerful on TV. And they've had really compelling witnesses across party lines come in and stand up and do the right thing and say that this country really should be about more than one person and more than one president.
Are there any other nuggets, call-outs that really stand out to you from the testimony that you think listeners should go back and watch or focus on?
I mean, for me, the day that the testimony came through about the president calling for magnetometers to be removed and knowing that the supporters were armed and wanting to go to the Capitol anyway, I think tells you just how deranged and crazed he was in the moment. And that, I think, was a breaking point for many people who watched the hearings from that day. That testimony was incredibly powerful, and it took a lot of courage for Cassidy Hutchinson to get out there and do that. I mean, again, this was a person who worked in his administration, who was a loyal Trump supporter, who saw what had happened and heard this story about what the president was doing and heard that he was aware that these people were armed. And she did the right thing at great risk to herself, put herself, her own life in jeopardy. I mean, his own family members and Bill Barr have in these testimonies said, look, we essentially that they knew that the election had not been stolen and that they told him that and that he continued anyway. And when you pair that with the statements from Cassidy Hutchinson on exactly what he was doing that day, it paints a very damning picture of the former president. And I just don't understand at this point how anybody can believe, regardless of political party, that is somebody who should be near our nuclear codes, near the Oval Office ever again. If you're a moderate Republican right now, or a Trump supporting Republican, isn't there somebody else in your party you can find who literally isn't going to try to overthrow the entire United States government to keep himself in power? Don't we all have enough self-respect to put somebody else up for a nominee on the Republican side of the aisle who is just going to stand up for America and the Constitution, and we can come back to a place where we're having substantive disagreements about tax policy or regulatory policy or energy policy? Because this kind of insane, destructive, anti-democratic messaging is beyond, and the country cannot tolerate it for the next 2 to 4 years, however long he hangs around.
You think, and I know I'm asking for a prediction here, which is a dangerous business, but do you think DOJ will charge Trump, set aside the classified documents for the moment, if you will, but do you think they will charge him with actions related to January 6th?
That's a tough one for me to answer. I mean, if you let me go into the classified documents one, I think that one looks to me a little bit more damning for him in terms of, you know, it's all damning for him, frankly, but I think in terms of criminal liability, the classified documents case is a much more straightforward case. But I think in some ways they're related in the sense that you need percipient witnesses who heard things that he said personally. And then you need documentary and text-based proof to corroborate the testimony from those percipient witnesses. And so I think the truth is that I don't know if he will be charged because I'm not in the room with the AUSAs and the FBI agents who have gotten all the grand jury subpoena returns, who have seen the search warrant returns, who've seen the call logs, the text messages to back up what we've seen under oath from a lot of the witnesses, and also exactly what the president knew and when he knew it. I think from the public record, there's probably enough evidence to indict him for something, you know, and certainly the I think the certification issue that there are a series of different charges that could be brought against him. But the question I think that the attorney general, the standard for an indictment is just probable cause, right? And the standard of whether you actually do that under the Justice Department's policy is you've got to be reasonably certain that you'll obtain the conviction. So it's a higher standard than just he probably committed a crime. And I think that is, in my estimation, where the Justice Department probably is is at this point, and we're also within 60 days of an election. I don't suspect that they will do anything before the midterms because unlike some prior folks at DOJ, they're not going to, I don't think this attorney general is going to get out ahead of the midterms with major investigative steps like that.
They learned from Tomey for sure. But you do think he'll be charged in the classified case? I'm just trying to read your body language here for those of our listeners. He's a very smart guy. He knows a lot of us. We're for Justice Department. Those of us who want to know, I'm putting you down for 51% or higher that he gets charged in that case.
Well, I think Mar-a-Lago. So we should frame this first, I think, because you really can't be talking enough about this issue. And when you're talking about top secret, sensitive, compartmented information that relates to human sources, you are talking about information that could result in people dying if it gets out. And so it's possible that people, sources, human sources overseas in foreign governments have already died as a result of this unbelievably reckless and what seems to me to be entirely intentional retention of classified documents. The second horrifying part of this, if you look at the public reporting, he kept information that was related to nuclear weapons material.
Amazing.
And that is not only jeopardizing individual human life, but regional, global stability and security. And there's been a lot of speculation about why he would have done this. Was it information about, an ally's nuclear capabilities that he wanted to give to another foreign government in exchange for something? And we just don't know what he was doing at this point. But you don't need to prove what he intended to do with these documents. You just need to prove that he knowingly kept them and retained them. And you don't even need to prove, as many other commentators have pointed out, you don't need to prove that they were or were not declassified. And we've already got a sworn statement from one of his lawyers that they returned all of the documents. That was obviously not true. I suspect that if you see the lawyers start to be indicted, I don't think his indictment would be long after that. But it is, again, it's one of those things where you have to really be in the room with the agents and the prosecutors to see what the totality of the evidence is that hasn't just been reported in the press. But that looks like an unbelievably damning case to him and certainly for his legal team. And then the question is going to become, are those lawyers going to be so confident that they feel willing to fall on some sword for him, or won't give investigators and won't cooperate with investigators about what he knew and when he knew it, that they're going to try to prevent an indictment that way? I think that's going to be the next sort of phase that we see following the lawyer indictments, because the lawyers certainly know exactly what they told him, and they know exactly what he was aware of, and they knew what the plan was, and whether the lawyers, for example, were ever told that he kept classified documents in his bedroom or in his office at Mar-a-Lago. And that kind of testimony is, I think, the missing piece of where that indictment comes down. And so after the election, I suspect more of these revelations will become public, and that's when we'll have a better sense of whether an indictment will actually happen.
In those conversations with the lawyers, when I hear all that discussion on the news, again, we're getting legally wonky here, but I've got a brilliant federal lawyer on the podcast, so I would ask. So is the way we should think about that is those are not privileged conversations, or at least that content is not privileged, because when you're talking about the commission of a crime, that's not subject to the attorney-client privilege. Is that what we're dealing with here?
That's right. There's a crime fraud exception to that. So you can't have privileged conversations with your lawyers in furtherance of a crime. There's also another way that these conversations come into play, which is the client themselves can waive the privilege by putting it at issue. And arguably, he, in some of his public statements, that he's come close to arguably doing that, I think. And if he later tries to claim, well, I didn't know about this, my lawyers told me all of these documents had been returned, that waives the privilege because he's relying on advice of counsel. And that at that point, what they've done, according to the public reporting, is they've set up privilege review team, or what they would normally do is set up a privilege review team. That's part of the special master issue that's also being litigated. But they would set aside communications with the lawyers that are potentially privileged. So there's going to be a team of people who would have access only to those communications and would not review them. And then there's going to be the investigative team that would look at non-privileged communications, but those will all be saved so that when these issues come out later, and when if the government were to make a prima facie showing, for example, that there was these communications were made in furtherance of the crime of retaining classified documents or national defense information documents, then a judge could find that those communications are not privileged, and the Justice Department could use them in a criminal case against the lawyers or the president.
So just at a high level, for anyone who wants to go back and look up some of these legal terms, DOJ ultimately can force, or maybe I should say a judge technically can force the lawyers to testify as to whether they told Trump he had to return the documents. Is that fair?
They could do that only if they were given compelled immunity. So there's two ways that could happen. The lawyers could agree to cooperate and could voluntarily testify in exchange for some kind of, you know, the expectation that they would hopefully receive a lighter sentence after they've been indicted. Then there's no Fifth Amendment issues there if they agree to do it voluntarily. If they don't agree to do it voluntarily, the Justice Department could ask a court to compel them to testify, but they would have immunity for that. So then they would have no Fifth Amendment privilege and they'd have compelled immunity. They'd still be forced to answer questions. They could still be subject to perjury, penalty of perjury. But that I'm not sure that we would see the Justice Department do that in this case. I think the more likely, that's a much rarer type of compelled immunity strategy that DOJ would use. I think what we are more likely to see is an indictment of the lawyer who swore under oath that they had returned all of the documents. And then that lawyer, if she expects to get leniency at sentencing and is getting good advice from her criminal defense attorneys, would agree to cooperate and testify voluntarily. But it is possible too, that the courts could, that they could subpoena her to testify, ask a court to compel her to testify and give her immunity. She wouldn't be able to be prosecuted for anything that she said. And there'd be no Fifth Amendment privilege there.
Okay. So then there's a lot here and you've done a great job illuminating. Last question on this topic. Is there any chance this is resolved before the 2024 election in your mind, given everything you just laid out?
Yeah, I actually do think so. And part of the reason I think so is because of how little public activity there was over the last 2 years after Merrick Garland became the attorney general. I mean, there were a lot of people, I mean, myself included, concerned, I think, about the pace of the investigation into January 6th and what was going on at the highest levels of the administration before and after January 6th. But what we've seen in the last 6 to 9 months is that they were extremely busy, I think, you know, looking into that. And the flurry of activity we've seen leading up to this next 2023 really has been a sign of how much progress they have made in the investigation. And I think there's a lot more progress they've made that still has not yet been made public. And it's a complex investigation, but I do think that before 2024, because they've spent time litigating some of these issues and because they've got so much accomplished already, it is very realistic that they could have some of these indictments handed down in 2023, well before the presidential election.
Not necessarily the prosecution in the case, but the indictments you feel like is a makeable putt.
Yeah, I do think that they're getting from the what we have seen publicly reported about the investigation. I do think that we could see indictments in 2023.
Okay. Well, I have kept you on some dense topics, but part of what we want to do is let the listeners just see how well qualified you are to deal with some really thorny issues that our country's got to tackle with. And I think the listeners can probably tell us very few people who are in a position to understand these things as well as you do. I can imagine you and Adam Schiff on MSNBC at night as members one day explaining these issues to Rachel Maddow and the rest of us. And, we need people who understand the complexity of what's going on, because these are weird, scary, dangerous times. And really grateful that you're making such a strong run at this race. If people want to find out more about your campaign, where they can help, where should they go?
Will Rollins for Congress.com, and it's R-O-L-L-I-N-S.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. Thanks for everything you're doing, and look forward to seeing you on the trail.
Thanks so much for having me.
We invite you to share ideas for guests, ask questions, and leave comments. You can find us at NeptuneOps.com. Follow us and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts as we continue to explore the inside stories driving California politics. This is the Nation State of Play podcast. I'm your host, Brian Miller, and thank you for listening.
Olas Media.